I'm Matt Bruce, and welcome to The Secret Life, the Business Owner Podcast. In this episode, we have someone that I find really inspirational. He's a runner, a speaker, a well-being and mental health awareness champion, and founder of Run For Your Mind Foundation. It's Ollie Newton. And we're going to hear about Ollie's daily battle with severe OCD, anxiety, and depression, and about now how he's raising awareness and supporting others through his foundation. I honestly feel so lucky and privileged that Ollie has decided to share his personal story with us. It's a story of resilience and a story of hope for anyone battling with mental illness. So from the depths of despair to Ollie rebuilding his life one run at a time, welcome to the secret life of a business owner. Welcome, Ollie, to the podcast. How are you, mate?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm quite tired. Not too bad. So let's start from the beginning. Let us know a little bit about you, a bit about Ollie Newton, where it all started off, and we'll go from there.
Brilliant. Well, for me, my journey with my mental health actually started when I was around 7 years old, and I can actually remember the first time that I kind of knew I was a little bit different. I was over in Spain on holiday with my family, and we were walking down a street, and I brushed a lamppost with my right hand, and around about 100 metres down the road, I had this overwhelming fear that if I didn't go back to the lamppost and touch it again, that my whole family were going to die. And that was kind of my very first kind of taste of what was to come. And little did I know really back then that it was going to kind of materialise into something quite frightening into my later years.
So you can actually go back to a point and say, I can remember something really distinctive that was the start of something happening in my life where I thought something wasn't quite.
Yeah, I think at that age, I definitely knew that I was different. I didn't really know what was going on, and I had to run back to the lamppost, and I touched it, and I honestly believed by running back to that lamppost, I saved everyone's life.
Amazing.
And little did I know that was kind of going to be the start of something. And probably about a year later, I think it was, I watched a film on monsters. I was 8 years old at this stage, and I had this kind of had this fear that there was monsters in my cupboard after watching a film. And I don't
not
really
Monsters
know.
Inc. Not
it
Monsters
wasn't
Inc.
Monsters Inc. I can't remember the film actually, and it's really frustrating because I talk about this a lot, and what that kind of brought was every night when I went to bed, I had to do these checks of my wardrobes, and I'd started off by doing one check of the wardrobe. So there was two wardrobes, and I checked behind my curtains in a little box at the bottom of my bed. And as time went on, I started to make mistakes. And as I started to make these mistakes, I used to build in further rituals to my evening routine. So I'd go to bed on a night, and it started off by just doing one lap of my room checking. And then as time went on, I started to make these mistakes. And every time I made a mistake, I'd build a further one into the routine. And it started off like this one or two times. Then within a couple of months, I was doing 48 laps in my bedroom on an evening.
Wow.
And I was just so frightened if I didn't do these checks that something bad was going to happen, something was going to happen to someone, my family member. And my dad and mum used to say in the morning, like, what on earth are you doing? Like, my dad used to joke to me, used to say, it sounds like I'm sleeping under Sheffield Greyhound track. He says, you sound like a greyhound going around a track.
It's going round and round and round, round and round and round.
Round and round. I'd go downstairs, and, you know, it was frustrating. I didn't really understand why I was doing it. And I couldn't really explain it to them because I didn't quite get it myself. And that was pretty much the start of it. And as time went on, I'd build in like other little rituals to my daily routine, like checking doors, making sure they weren't locked going back, making sure they're locked again, and just silly things and stepping on grates and so on. And I really didn't understand why I was feeling like I was feeling, why I was having to do these things. And don't get me wrong, I just want to be clear. Like, my childhood was, I was very fortunate growing up. I was brought up in a great family with great morals. And
I'm very lucky to know your family, and I can definitely say, the Newtons are top notch, and great
Appreciate
family
that.
Unit. And you can see that from the outside in. You can see that the Newtons have something, and a little bit wider than Newtons in the extended family as well. You can see, definitely see you've got that close, tight knit unit, and everyone looks out for each other, and certainly you and your brother, and I've met your dad, all seem really close. and like support each other. It's fantastic to see.
Thanks. Yeah, I am in that respect. I've been incredibly lucky, and I think that, you know, that's probably why I'm here today still, because I've had that support and I've had them people who've pretty much stood by me every step of the way. And these little things that were creeping into my life were frustrating, but they didn't affect the way I was living as such. It was just annoying. And it wasn't really until I was around 21 years old when my life really kind of came crashing down. And I'd been on a night out with some friends, and we were at one of the lads' houses afterwards, and one of the lads had seen one of the other guys cheat on his partner the evening before. Mm. And he was convinced that he hadn't done it, but two people had seen him do it. And he was like, I was so drunk, it doesn't matter. I can't remember doing it, so I didn't do it. And something clicked in my head that day, and it made me all of a sudden doubt myself. Imagine if I'd done something on a night out. And I know I've just touched on kind of how I was brought up and how I was raised, but my morals were off the chain. Like, I'd never do anything to hurt anyone. I'd never do anything to upset anyone. And then all of a sudden, and at the time I was in a relationship, I was happy, I was settled. And all of a sudden I was kind of hit with this kind of like fear of what happens if you've done this, what happens if you've done that. And
does that sort of, it's really interesting. So when you were younger up till that point, you were just sort of like managing with some and coping with something that wasn't deeply impacting your life, but you could tell something was not quite right, but you'd built in all these routines into your life and the way you operated. And then again, another moment where you sort of, something else clicks and it takes you into a different dimension.
Yeah, and at that time, little did I know that the two were very much kind of entwined. They were like two of the same things, really. But at that moment in my life, I didn't know what was going on. And then all of a sudden it came into effect for absolutely everything. You know, like it'd be things like hurting people, doing something, anything unlawful, cheating, anything. And what I ended up doing for that next couple of months is I ended up going back over every single night out I'd ever been on, you know, creating these like false memories. And these memories were just causing me like the world of pain and anxiety. Yeah. And anxiety would from the thoughts would lead to depression, and I'd find myself in states of depression for like months and months on end, just constantly convincing myself that I could be a bad person, I could have done something wrong, when I know full well that I'd never have done that, and never in a million years.
Yeah. I mean, not can't quite relate fully, but when you were certainly, like, you know, people when they're younger, they have this thing called beer fear, don't they, where you go out and have a few too many beers. You don't remember what's happened. You wake up the next morning thinking, oh dear, what have I done? And that fear of dread, that fear of like, I don't know what I've done. I don't know who I've upset. I don't remember saying goodbye to people. It's like a blank. And then you start creating a few memories, don't you, to like fill in the gaps. But to have that, you know, for your mind to then keep thinking about every night out you've had, creating those illusions basically in your own mind to justify things or, you know, make you feel in different ways. It's quite terrifying from your perspective.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think what the average person can do with these thoughts is they trust their how they behave, and they know full well that, you know, they won't have done anything that's really going to have caused any problems. But for me, with what I was going through, you know, these had totally taken over my mind, almost hijacked it, and they weren't giving me a moment to think of anything other than what happens if you've done that, what happens if you've done this, and, you know, and all of my thoughts were almost based around my morals. And it wasn't really until probably about 2 years later where I decided that I couldn't cope with the way I was feeling. Mm. I had to leave the relationship because, you know, I was so depressed, I was so low, and I was constantly convincing myself I could have done something wrong.
How do you think that affected sort of like the people around you and your home life at that time? Did you, obviously you probably at that point weren't thinking about them, you just think about yourself in your own mind, but have you had time to sort of speak to them about what they thought you were like at that moment in time? Did they recognize that in you? Did they?
Totally. I'd gone from being that guy who I'd say that everybody would kind of come to for anything.
Yeah.
I was the person who had everybody round every weekend together, got everyone together. You know, we'd have drinks at my family's house before when I was growing up. And then all of a sudden,
life and
soul, I disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I became an absolute hermit. I deleted everybody off Facebook. I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't want to see what anyone else was doing. I cut friendship ties. You know, a few of my friends who kind of were my closest have always stood by me through it all. And even then I was trying to push them away. I was trying to push family away. And I physically ran away. I moved over to Spain. Wow. I took a job in Spain because I physically couldn't cope. I moved over there. I mean, I wasn't really...
Is that just take literally to go
back? I had to get away.
Got to take myself out of what's going on here and hope that, in the hope that if I change the surroundings, if I change everything around what's around me at the moment, I can just start afresh. And
exactly.
And hopefully it'll just, you know, something will click in and it'll work.
Yeah, exactly. And it was probably, you know, I look back and I've got great memories while I was over there, but a lot of them weren't, you know, it was very clouded. I turned to alcohol actually to almost numb the pain.
Yeah.
Thankfully, my mum was a school nurse, so I never touched any drugs, and she always drilled that into me. But you know, I was probably smoking cigarettes when I didn't really smoke. I was drinking heavily just to try and fit in with the crowd over there, but also to try and numb the pain of the way I was feeling.
Yep.
And you know, I kind of totally lost my way altogether. And you know, all of these thoughts I was having were kind of around my morals, and I'd seen therapists while I was in the UK before I took the plunge and moved away and took and made that massive step and change.
So obviously you recognised something wasn't quite right and go and speak to people, you know, seek out different remedies, different, you know, try different things just to try and fix it.
Yeah, but it was strange because nobody told me what was actually wrong with me. I was treated as if it was almost like an anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
But I moved over to Spain, and it was actually thankfully for one of the one of my mates over there, his missus had moved over at the same time, and she was a psychiatrist and she was working in the hospital over there. And it was, I got her around and I said, look, can you come and help me? Because I don't know what's going on. Like I physically cannot live a normal life anymore. I'm not me. And she's like, and she sat me down, and after 5 minutes, she just said to me, you've got OCD. And I said to her, like, this isn't OCD. This isn't me like doing things in order. This isn't me tidying up or doing certain things.
Like the traditional
misconception, you know, of what it actually
is. Have that idea of OCD. It's you know, somebody opening a kitchen cupboard and all the baked bean cans are all facing the same way and everything's lined up and the towels are all straight.
Yeah,
you know, you hear stories like David Beckham and Gazza, don't you, and stuff like that. And
exactly, and that's the problem we've got actually, and I think that was the difficulty for me growing up in an age where OCD was very much kind of trivialized, and there's this huge media misconception of OCD as to what it actually is. And she just said to me, look, you've got OCD in the form of intrusive negative thoughts, rumination, and it's just a different format, just a million times worse. And I was like, well, you know what? This kind of makes sense, because actually growing up, I had all these OCD traits, but I didn't really understand what OCD was, mainly because when I was growing up, you'd see on TV things like obsessive compulsive cleaners on Channel 4, and you'd see, you know, all sorts of programs kind of revolving around like OCD as if it was almost like some form of kind of joke of a disease, when you know, it's when you read into it, and I've spent the last kind of 10 years now since finding out what was wrong with me, kind of researching it and learning about it to try and better understand myself. You know, it's one of the top 10 most debilitating diseases in the world, you know, in ways of like loss of earnings and loss of life.
Wow.
You know, people get caught up in this cycle of, you know, being stuck with these thoughts that are frightening. You know, I have some absolutely horrifying thoughts of things that I can't even discuss with you, because, you know, mentally it's everything that I despise. So you just think of anything that you dislike, and, you know, and that's what my mind's telling me I could be. And it's awful. It ruins, you know, I've lost probably 10 years of my life to OCD. From the age of 23 to 33, I didn't have any way of, you know, I wasn't me. I'd lost everything pretty much, other than the people around me. And that's why I'm here today.
Yeah. It's really interesting as well when you say, you know, the stereotype of what people think in terms of OCD. And certainly I'm guilty of that. And until I'd sort of read more about your story and, you know, read up about on your website, for example, a little bit more in depth about you. Because it's also one of them awkward ones, isn't it? Like, we've seen each other before in the past, and I've never asked you the question, so Ollie, tell me about these conditions that you've got. It's not something that I would have done then. But then reading about it on your website, it's a real, and listening to, you know, your vlogs and your Instagram stories and things like that, it really brings home to me that actually we need to have a proper understanding of the complexities of some of these conditions, because like you said, it's very evident that once you understood it, you made a really nice comment, sort of you understood who you were then, and then you can sort of start piecing it together.
Yeah, I've just been trying to rebuild my life, really, because I lost it totally. I lost total control. You know, I was an absolute, the shadow of a man. I wasn't doing anything that I could have done before. You know, I spent, there was a time of around 10 years where I couldn't physically go to the pub with my friends for a beer. Not a single beer, because a lot of my thoughts were revolved around cheating and revolved around nights out. So I wouldn't put myself in that position.
Yeah. But whereas before, you were the life and soul of the party.
Exactly, yeah. And it's frightening what mental health, you know, the impact it can have on your lives and what it can do. And, you know, and I talk about OCD and the stereotypes around OCD. And, you know, it's not your fault that you feel the way you do about what it is, because it's just people, it's the way it's kind of, you know,
talked about in the media and
how it's talked about amongst people. Yeah. You know, the amount of times I go to work and someone will say to me, that I see them lining the screen up, and I'm just like, they'll say to me something like, I'm just a little bit OCD. And to me, it's like, I'm not one of them people who's easily offended, but like, I'll always try and correct them and say like, you know, that's just like almost a personality quirk. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, OCD isn't putting your left shoe on in front of your right. OCD is something that's debilitating. If it's affecting your life, it's OCD. If it's not, it's a personality quirk. And that's what I need to kind of, you know, I'm on a mission really to kind of expose it for what it is, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you've got people like Khloe Kardashian. I've seen something on Twitter and across the OCD world recently. There was uproar because she was posting about Khloe CD because she's tidy. And then you've got the likes of H&M doing Christmas jumpers, obsessive Christmas disorder with OCD in big letters. And it's just like, would you do that about any other disease? No, you wouldn't put, you know, and you wouldn't put that about anything, any other disease. And you wouldn't kind of, you know.
Especially at the moment where, and rightly so, in the world, mental health has got, thankfully, a really strong, it's becoming like there's a strong platform there now for people to speak out, for other people to listen to them, you know, about issues and about how to cope and coping mechanisms. And I think, you know, when you see brands doing something so openly as that, it's sort of like two steps forward, three back.
It's kind of, you wonder who it has to go through for it to get to that stage. Do you know what I mean? Like,
what,
someone must pick up on it before they're like, oh, I'm going to distribute this jumper and sell this jumper. It's like, where, you know, someone must understand it.
I actually
kind of think, wow, it's quite funny, really, that we're in this. But at the same time, it's like, when's it going to end? And, you know, over the last couple of years, and I've met some incredible people who suffer with OCD. And, you know, one person I spoke to about her OCD was, she lives 15 minutes from work, right? And she will drive to work and she'll set off an hour and a half early because she believes that every time she goes over a bump that she's potentially run someone over. So what she does is she'll drive, she'll hit a bump, and then she'll pull up a car, she'll walk back up the road, check that there's no one there, and she'll get back in a car. And so for every journey she has to make, she has to give herself an extra couple of hours. And it's like, you know, these things are, you know, so controlling. You know, I was really, honestly, controlled, totally consumed by OCD for close to 10 years. I am still controlled and consumed by OCD now, but I'm learning to live with it. And I'm using it almost as kind of, using it to my advantage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm using my weakness now as a strength. And you know, I believe really that there's definitely light at the end of the tunnel. But like, you know, a real good example is like, they did some tests throughout at a university, Cambridge University, about people who have intrusive thoughts, but not kind of the person who suffers with intrusive thoughts, just anybody as a whole. So they did tests on thousands of people.
Yeah.
And just the average people. And they said that 20% of people had the urge when at a train station or a bus stop to push someone in front of a train or push someone in front of a bus. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't had this thought, it'd probably sound shocking. Mm. But the average person would just label that as a thought. It'd just be a thought, and then they'd move on. They're not going to do it. You know you're not going to push somebody.
Yeah, but, and then it's forgotten about.
And it's forgotten about.
Yeah.
For me, I've had the thought of pushing someone in front of a train, and I've lived the fear and guilt attached to that thought for 3 months, as if I'd actually physically pushed them in front of a train, as if I was actually a murderer, because that's another thing I obviously despise. So it's like, think of anything you hate, you know, put yourself, and your mind is constantly telling you that you could be that person, you could have done that thing. And it's like... Yeah.
And then going back to what you said at the start about, you know, about your morals and about how that thought then coupled with your morals escalates into all these other thoughts that have sort of like multiplied off the back of it.
Massively. And then it's just like one after another. It's like, it's almost like you're kind of rewinding it, playing it. You know, it's like on repeat constantly.
Yeah.
And it got to a stage where around, you know, 4 years ago, I was sat at work and I'd battled hard with this disease for close to 10 years at this stage.
So before that, going back to you were about 21, I think, when you said you went off to Spain and...
Yeah.
A friend who's a psychiatrist had, you know, basically diagnosed you.
Yeah, so this was actually when... No, I moved to Spain when I was probably 23.
A bit later.
I started to suffer when I was 21 with these thoughts, and I ran away when I was 23. I was diagnosed probably when I was about 24, maybe.
And so from that period, when you were 24, after finding out, I've said, you sort of briefly said that you did a bit of research. After finding out, how did your life change up until, you know, when you were saying just like 2017 then?
Truthfully, it didn't. It got worse. And I tried and tried and tried to learn about what was going on in my head.
Yeah.
But I was finding myself dropping and sinking deeper and deeper into, you know, up until probably 4 years ago, I'd probably be depressed for 11 months of the year. And how I'd manage my OCD and my thoughts is I would be stuck in a process, and the process was so familiar and it was very, very much the same every time. Mm. So for me, it'd start with a thought, which was my OCD. The OCD would cause me the world of anxiety because I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop convincing myself that I could have done something that I knew I hadn't done. And then I'd literally plummet into a state of depression. And that state of depression would last maybe 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
So it would be a process of 3 months. And then what I'd do then is I'd try and put myself in a position again to replace the thought with a different thought.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know, at this stage, I couldn't really go out. I couldn't really do anything. It was absolutely terrifying. Mm. You know, the way I was living. And I was having it was that bad that I was having to document my every single move. So for me, the iPhone notes at the time were a blessing. They were like, wow, I've got this way of kind of having a date and stamp for every move I've made.
For every action.
But actually, it was probably the catalyst of all my issues, because I was leaving the house. You know, I was noting up that I hadn't tried to kiss somebody, I hadn't done anything unlawful. Mm-hmm. I hadn't pushed somebody, I hadn't
going
hurt
back to
somebody.
Going back to the morals again.
All around the morals.
Matching off every action or inaction you take, matching it back off to a moral to say, I'm behaving, I'm within these boundaries, I'm living the right life.
Exactly,
I'm doing the
just
right
constantly
thing.
Reminding myself. And I'd have my cap on, and I got to a stage where my cap would be over my eyes because I physically didn't want to look at anybody but the ground. And I'd walk along and I'd get to work and I'd put on this persona and I'd change the way I was and I'd try my hardest, whereas people who were close to me knew I'd sit myself in a corner and they could see I was struggling. And people at work started to realise they could see that I was going through a real tough time. But, you know, it was really challenging, it was really difficult, and I'd make notes even whilst at work. And it was, you know, if anybody invaded my space, I'd have to write something about it. If anyone was close to me, I'd have to write something about it. I hadn't hurt somebody, I hadn't done something, you know, anything. It was silly. You know, the notes were, and I'd get home on an evening and I'd literally read my whole day back. And sometimes it'd be 100, 150 notes in my iPhones.
Wow.
In iPhone notes section. And I'd have to go through the whole thing and it would probably take me about half an hour. And, you know, by that stage of the day, I was knackered. I also had these, as long with the thoughts, I also had the rituals were in there, which I'll talk about a little bit later on, because we unearthed them again, you know, at a later stage, and little did I know they were all still there. But because the thoughts had taken center stage, you know, my life had, I was totally gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously come back to the UK, you're working, obviously you said that people at work were picking up on that the fact that something wasn't quite right and that you weren't yourself and that there might be an issue there. Obviously that's something we hear a lot at the moment. And certainly, you know, one of our clients, leading health and wellbeing provider, doing a lot around mental health and stuff like that. And I think trying to bring that idea of mental health support into the workplace. And we're going back to, was it 2017, I think, or 4 years ago?
Yeah. That's when my life pretty much changed for the better.
And did somebody at work pick up on, was it work that somebody noticed it at work, or how did work support you, or did they not support you?
They've been incredible.
That's amazing.
Time, you know, I've been in a job, and I've been in the same job probably for around 7 or 8 years, because to be honest with you, it was just about earning enough money to live. I've never been one who's been, I've always wanted to do well in life, but I never knew really where I was going, because my life was kind of cut short at 20, 22, 23 years old. That was it. You know, I was progressing in life. I was happy. I was doing well. And then all of a sudden, you know, I've got a gap now of 10 years missing, really. And it's only really over the last 4 years that I've been able to rebuild my life. And, you know, turn this whole negative thing into something a little bit more positive. And I was sat at work in June 2017, and I'd been struggling for some time. My manager was aware, because I'd brought it to his attention. And he put his hand...
Sorry to interrupt you, Oliver. That's the first thing there is you're saying that you've brought it to his attention. I think credit to you, mate, for even at that time when it maybe wasn't something to be like more positively spoken about, for you to actually make somebody aware, say, look, I am struggling, by the way.
I think it was so obvious as well. But at the same time that I was starting to open up about how I was feeling. And it's been very much the making of me. It's totally changed my life. It's created incredible opportunities. And he just put his hand on my shoulder and he just said, look, I can see you're really struggling. And he said, look, I want you to take 2 months off. We'll pay you. We'll support you as a business. You know, you've been here a long time. We respect you for what you do, and we want to stand by you and help you. And, you know, I think for me, it was actually kind of that moment there that really kind of made me think, wow, you know, I need to do something, because I had the support from my family. Granted, I'd probably lost a lot of friends, and I wouldn't say I'd lost them, because I can quite easily, I'll be able to rebuild them bridges and these friendships, you know, over the last couple of years, I've been able to do that again. But, you know,
But that takes time.
I'd lost my way. I wasn't in the groups I was in before. I wasn't amongst it like I used to be. I wasn't able to go out or do anything. Yep. And he just said to me, take some time off. And, you know, at that stage, I thought, you know, I've got my family, I've got my work supporting me, I need to do something. And, you know, it didn't quite start off as easily as that. I'd woken up the next day, and it'd take me 4 hours every day to get out of bed, because I didn't want to open my eyes, because I knew as soon as I opened my eyes, I'd have to face the day again. And I physically couldn't cope with that feeling. I couldn't cope with going through it all again. I hated having to live the life I did when I knew I wanted so much more.
Yeah.
And I'd woken up that day, I'd been in bed probably 4 hours. I'd been awake, but my eyes were shut, and I could tell it was warm outside. And because the sun, you know, when I opened my eyes, the sun was coming through the curtains. I was like, I need to do something. And I don't know why I did it. And I made a decision, and it's a decision that I truly believe has like changed my life. And in fact, I honestly feel it saved my life, because I don't feel like I could have gone any longer how I was. And I went into my cupboard and I put on a pair of old gym trainers and some gym kit. I was never really a runner, but I left the house and I started to run. And I probably ran 500 meters, stopped, and then walked a little bit. Ran again, and it was
probably... I don't think I could make 500 metres now.
Well, to be honest with you, I think it was just... I certainly wasn't fit at the time, but I hadn't, you know, I hadn't really drank for some time. I was trying my hardest to eat better because of... But, you know, you turn to these bad foods when you're struggling. It's not always as easy as that. And I, after about 40 minutes of this running and kind of stopping, I probably ran about 5K. And I was hit with this feeling that I'd not felt for 10 years. Nothing came close. It was like all of a sudden it had this like moment's respite from the thoughts that I was having. And
like the fog cleared a bit.
Totally. And don't get me wrong, it was a short term fix. It might have lasted half an hour. But what I learned in time was over 2 weeks, I was building it up. In 2 weeks, I was running 15 kilometers. You know, in a month and a half, I was running half marathons. And I found that the more and the further I ran, the easier it was getting in my mind to manage the way I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And the days were getting brighter. I was starting to feel the old me again. You know, I was probably 50% of the person I was, you know, eventually. But at the same time, you know, I was starting to all of a sudden, like, piece my life back together.
Take back a little bit.
One run by one run. And it was just like, it was, yeah, all of a sudden I had a little bit of control. I was struggling bad, don't get me wrong, and I was still caught in these vicious cycles. But all of a sudden I just kind of, there was a bit of hope. And I almost lived for that feeling. I mean, the best way to describe running to me is it's almost like the thoughts, the OCD's chasing me. It's like it's always hot on my tail.
Yep.
But the further I run, the easier it gets, and the more the better chance of a better day I have, and I live for that. I live for that moment, and you know, I'd kind of gone from like being nobody, like total hermit, like I'd totally lost my life, and then all of a sudden I started to feel like I was worth something again, and I had to do something. I thought, you know, I wanted to do something to kind of document my every move, not like I was doing before with the iPhone notes, but actually document it to other people to show, you know, my journey, kind of my road to recovery. Yeah.
Your coping mechanism.
Yeah.
If you can, you know, publicise your coping mechanism, maybe that will help somebody cope with something they're dealing with.
Exactly.
Be it the same or slightly different, but it's a nice mechanism to share and say, look, this has worked for me. Take it or leave it. If it might work for you,
exactly. And I just believe that this was it. This was the way forwards. This can change anybody's life. And I just set out and I set up a page called Run for Your Mind, which is my page now, my business. And it was just with no real kind of direction as to where I was going with it. I just wanted to document what I was doing, how I was feeling. I set it up through Instagram, really with the hope to kind of support, motivate and inspire other people who are struggling with mental illness to try and use running as a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And it started off by, you know, me just writing blog posts on Instagram. And then we set up a website with my friend who's been incredible for me. He's one person that, one of the people that's really stood by me through it all. And I'm grateful for him. And he basically, you know, helped me kind of set up this website, and I was able to kind of document everything I was doing and how I was feeling, and just being brutally honest. Not, you know, I wasn't holding back.
Yeah. Was the website and the Instagram page at that time, was that more your part of your mechanism of coping? And it wasn't actually, I don't know where the website or the Instagram page is going to end up. It's just how that's helping me cope at the moment. And then it's actually grown into something that's really powerful.
Exactly.
Really,
I mean, for me, I just wanted to open conversation. And what I've been able to do through that is, you know, I really wanted to kind of help other people, but in turn, it's massively helped me because it's made me realize that these thoughts that I'm having, I'm not alone. There's loads of people having these exact same thoughts. And, you know, I was very fortunate with the support I had around me from, you know, my incredible wife who's been the person really who started this journey off, because, you know, when I met her 6 years ago, she saw me in an absolute terrible state. You know, she saw me,
probably saw you at
my very
worst.
Lowest. Yeah. And I said to her, like, when I met her, I said, look, you don't want anything to do with me, and I'm absolutely nuts. Like I said, honestly, I'm crackers. But she decided she wanted to persevere, and she is one person that has been the driving force behind everything I do. Because, you know, for them first couple of years, we tried everything, every therapy under the sun. I spent thousands. But, you know, she's supported me with my ideas with Run For Your Mind. She's helped drive the the ideas forwards, and we've, you know, through kind of her allowing me to talk to her, it's allowed me to talk to more people. Because, you know, just an example of how damaging and how controlling the thoughts are. I can have a thought, that I've cheated on my partner with someone. And there was months and months on end where I physically couldn't even kiss my wife because my mind was telling me I was kissing somebody else. And that is how powerful the mind can be and how frightening and damaging it can be. And I had to say to her, look, this is the reason why I can't kiss you, because I'm having these thoughts. And not many people would stand by, you know. I'm not saying not many people would, because there's some great people, but, you know, for her to have, you know, she deserves a lot of credit for everything.
And just recognized you're in a, she recognized that's not you.
Yeah, and she's got me to where I am today, and she's got me believing, and she has been an absolute ray of light, really, when it comes to, like,
I love that.
You know, kind of rebuilding my life and getting me to where I am. And you know, with Run For Your Mind, it started off, like I said, just as an Instagram and a website. We set up a Strava club. There's now, you know, I think my...
Do you want to know how many people are on a Strava club? Because I've done my research, Ollie, by the way, because I'm a really professional podcast host. So Strava club, Run For Your Mind, 3,324 members.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Wow.
Yeah, so that's just, you know, that's 3,000, you know. So that, I think my initial goal really with Run For Your Mind was to set up clubs everywhere around the world and just have all these running clubs in different cities. And I may have missed the boat with that due to my social anxiety, but I turned it into more of an online sort of virtual thing. Way before virtual stuff was cool, yeah. Before COVID. And I've managed to, you know, we've got a great group of people where we all support each other and help each other, and they're all running for the same reason. And it's, you know, this whole thing is kind of...
There's people posting big numbers on there.
Unbelievable.
Big distances.
Yeah, you'll see my cousin on there. He's absolutely crackers. He runs about 160K a week. And wow. It's like...
How much are you running at the moment a week?
I average around 100 kilometres a week, yeah.
Wow, love
so
that.
I think in the last time I checked, over the last 4 years, I've covered around 16,000 kilometres.
Jeez Louise.
So I think it averages out at about, I think it's 15 or 16,000. So I think it works out around 12K a day maybe or something. Along
I was, I remember, I've got a distinct memory of... because I know your brother, you know, quite well, and we'd never really spoken properly, I think, before then. Obviously knew who each other were, but not really knew each other properly. And I remember seeing something that Sam had liked, and then all like reposted this Run For Your Mind, and it was you running. I was thinking, wow, that's amazing. And then I sort of heard the story behind it as part of the posts that you're posting and the videos, and I was just like, that is so inspiring. And then just to see how it's snowballed and you know, people have really taken to it. And I know a lot of people say talk about timing, but you started to do that to help yourself and to then to start helping other people. But then COVID happened in between. And I think the content you're posting now is even more important than it ever was.
Yeah, it's more relative than it's ever been.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I think... COVID has been one of the most challenging things for me, but at the same time, it's probably, you know, it's been the making of me, I'd say. Because, you know, after setting up, kind of just going back a little bit before that, after setting up Run For Your Mind, you know, I did my first half marathon 2 months later. I was back in work.
I think it was that got me. I think I'd seen that you'd run a half marathon and you'd only been running for like not long at all. And I'm thinking, wow. That's incredible.
I know, and I wasn't really built. I mean, I probably am built for running now, but I didn't really at the time. I wasn't, and you know, I did a half marathon, I think, in the September, which was about 2.5 months after setting up Run For Your Mind, or going off six, should I say, and then within a year, I'd ran a 100-kilometer ultra marathon, but it wasn't even so much about the running. It was kind of like it was about the life I was starting to live. All of a sudden, you know, these doors were opening again. I was all of a sudden able to go for a drink with my friends. And I hadn't done that for such a long time, you know. And it's the little things that people take for granted, You know, the things that you could just do, or the average person could just do whenever they want. Mm. You know, going for a beer with my friends was probably one of the biggest successes I've had over the last 4 years, because all of a sudden that was what I wanted to do. And, you know, that was me kind of rebuilding again. And, you know, people started to pick up on what I was doing. In early 2019, I was picked up by a running brand called Hoka One, which are a massive, massive running brand. They're one of the biggest now. And they featured me across all their campaigns for mental health, the Humans of Hoka campaign it was called. And they just allowed me to share my story across all their social platforms. It went out to millions of people. And, you know, it was incredible that someone like that was supporting me. They sent me some kind of trainers and stuff as a thank you. I don't really ever accept anything from people, because I like to just, I don't like affiliation as such. But because I was doing something for them, I thought, you know, they might be able to help me.
And it's good kit as well, by the way.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's great. Great running kit. And they sent me some trainers through. Unfortunately, I didn't get on with them. And I say unfortunately because running, they say, is cheap. But if you run like I run, I mean, I go through a pair of trainers every 5 weeks, and it costs me 150 quid to buy a new pair. And I have to, and I frustratingly fell into a pair of running shoes purely because I bought them because they had the same surname as, they were called Newtons. I was like, I'm going to buy them. Now they're impossible to get hold of. I have to import them from like Canada or somewhere up in the mountains over there, and it cost me a fortune. So I've actually switched recently to Nikes. But, you know, I was grateful for a pair of free shoes and the opportunity to kind of get some at a discounted rate through Hoka, but it didn't quite work out. I felt like I was floating in them, which is probably a good thing, but I like to be able to feel the floor, and they're like really high, but that's not really a very interesting conversation anyway, they didn't work for me anyway. And you know, little things started to happen, which was just like incredible, really. Like I got nominated for my blog for the running awards, and that got picked up, and I got shortlisted because my I got down to the final stages, and I was meant to be over at the award ceremony a couple of years ago, but that was the year that COVID hit, and I was on the London Marathon. I had a place, and it was the couple of nights before, so I was going down, and I didn't actually win anything, but it was just incredible just to be recognised. You know, after
when you think about your journey, and you think about, you know, the whole journey, the whole process, like where you've come from, the things you've had to cope with, the things you've had to overcome, to have that little bit of recognition that says, Ollie, mate, you're on the right track. And not only that, you're inspiring and helping other people as well, just with your message. That's a nice little pat on the back, even if you don't win the trophy or whatever, or medal or whatever it was.
I was just so grateful to be noticed, really. And, you know, and kind of, from there, you know, over the last couple of years, I've really been able to kick on, and, you know, I've kept kind of running, I've kept talking about what I'm going through, been really open. A lot of people can really connect to what I'm talking about, and, you know, it helps a lot of people. And it was 3 years ago now, two and a half years ago, I got the opportunity to deliver a talk at a work event. They basically were doing a feature. So I worked for Sky Betting and Gaming, and they've been incredible support for me over the years. I mean, when I came back off sickness, long-term sick, they incorporated running breaks mid-shift. They've done all sorts of incredible things. And one thing they did was they allowed me to tell my story, which they did a feature called The Untold Stories of Sky Betting and Gaming. And it was at a work event, and it was on the set of Victoria at Leeds Bradford Airport in this big bunker. It was incredible. And little did I know that I'd be sat on delivering my first public speaking event sat on Victoria's bed in front of about 200 people. And the picture's just hilarious because I just look absolutely terrified. And I'm there, and I just thought, you know, I'm going to give it a crack and see what happens.
That
was my first ever time I'd ever spoke in front of anyone, like, an audience about what I was doing.
How did you find that?
Awful. Like, you know, something like, this is the thing, like, I find this whole public speaking thing incredibly difficult. And that's the exact reason why I'm doing it, because my motto now in life is to put myself in these positions again that I could never have dreamt of doing, you know, a few years ago when I was totally trapped.
Yeah.
And learning to become comfortable feeling uncomfortable is my motto of life. You know, if a friend says to me, do you want to go for a beer? My mind's telling me absolutely not. But I'm saying yes, and I'll be there because I've got to do it. And, you know, to do, you know, to be asked to do that at a work event, not in a million years would I want to do it. You know, my anxiety was awful. You know, it's bad enough with the anxiety I've got and the OCD and the thoughts and you know, I was pretty much I was depressed at the time anyway. Though I was feeling a little bit better because I was able to manage my days through running. And I just sat down and told my story, and you know, it was the kind of after that what came on the back of it was incredible, because we were like, wow, you know, is there any way we can help you?
Yeah, do you think because you did feel you know, anxious about talking for the first time in front of people, and it was, you know, uncomfortable for you, do you think that vulnerability actually helps people listen a bit closer? Because I don't know what you think. I find when I listen to people who I can see are being very emotional, and you can see they're uncomfortable talking about it, but they're talking about it, I always feel like the room goes quiet and everybody just hones in on what they're saying, and you listen to every single word, every breath, because you can feel their vulnerability.
Absolutely.
And it actually relates so much more, and it's so much more powerful.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is the whole thing. And, you know, what we'll touch on shortly with where I am now with what I'm doing, like it's all about mental resilience. It's all for me, you know, I've turned to speaking now to try and make a difference, really, you know, to try and change the way I'm thinking. But I'm really vulnerable. Like, you know, you can see that from the start. I'm not these people that are seeing my talks, and you know, you might be labeled up as a motivational speaker, but you know, they're not doing front flips as they leave the room, put it that way. I'm not motivating them in that respect, but what I am saying is, look, there's hope for anyone battling mental illness, whether it's you, your family member, or anyone you're supporting. There's hope, and that's all, and that for me is the main message. And work basically said to me on the back of my on the back of that talk, they said, is there any way we can support you? And at work, what we have is something called the development fund, which is £1,000 a year. You can invest in whatever you want and your own personal development, which I think is incredible. And they were like, well, use some of the development fund, get yourself on a public speaking course. And I did it. Did I enjoy it, or did I find it beneficial? Yes, I found it beneficial. I thought it was incredible. But was it me as a speaker? Probably not. You know, these public speaking things, I think they're aimed at people who are doing TED Talks, which are a little bit more, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I love watching a TED Talk, but I'm a vulnerable speaker. It's just a real story. Yep. I'm not, you know, I'm not saying what they're saying is not real, but it's very much kind of a scripted, you know.
It's a different process.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's a very different process. And it's something I love watching. I've seen some incredible TED Talks, but is it what I'm about? Probably not,
it's
but
not
I learn a lot.
It's not how you pitch your message, is it?
I'm not here to say I'm not the finished article. I'm not someone who's better. Actually, I'm probably still struggling now, as bad as I probably could have been before, but I'm just learning to understand it better.
Yep.
It's almost like a superpower now. I'm just using it to my advantage.
Yeah. So let's go run for your mind. I believe you have a foundation now. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah. So with the talks and stuff, it was going, you know, incredibly well on the back of that. So I started to do talks, you know, I got contacted through some incredible companies, you know, and you know, my first talk online, because what happened with COVID is which we'll touch on the foundation in a second, because I can come to that, but basically with COVID, my whole routine was stripped away from me. I lost my way totally, you know. I fell into this state of depression. The reason why I became so depressed is because it was on the back of doing something absolutely crazy. What I decided to do on about a month and a half into when we were put in lockdown, and I know we were all in the same situation, which was kind of nice for me in some respects, because we're all struggling in the same way, but everyone's different, aren't they? And it's just who can cope. And I think, like you said earlier, you touched on earlier, like, you know, it's so relative, like everything now, that it all makes sense as to what I'm doing. And And I decided that, you know, on a Monday evening, I was going to do a run on Friday. I was going to do 100 kilometers around my block. So I was going to run, and I measured my block. So I live on a crescent, and it was 100. Around the block, it was 780 meters. So I was going to have to do 130 laps of my crescent, right? So I set off at 12 o'clock at lunchtime, and I said I'm going to finish by 12 o'clock the following day. And the reason why I wanted to do it at 12 o'clock the following day is because if I would have set off at like 6 or 7 in the morning and finished at like 11 at night, no one would have been involved. And there were so many kids on our street. As soon as I mentioned it, they were like, oh, we want to be involved. And at this stage, we'd just been locked down. No one could actually physically stand amongst each other, but everyone could stand in the garden. And I, and you know, I did this 100-kilometer run around the street. The, honestly, I was cheered every single step of the way for the whole time.
And I remember seeing videos and thinking, what a phenomenal,
unbelievable! It's like a race I've never ran. You know, it's like a race when it's just me in it. And it was just and all the support, you know, at 50 kilometres, I got a video message from Gary Lineker wishing me well.
Yeah.
You know, we raised £6,000 for the Trussell Trust in 5 days. And it was just unbelievable. The local press, the local radio, everyone was, you know, it was all over. And it was just one of them experiences that, you know, for me, it's sad actually, because it was one of the greatest achievements I've probably done. But actually what happened on the following week was typical of my mental health. Like whenever something big happens, I plummet. So for me, it's trying to learn to level out and learn to kind of live, you know, at a very level, not get overexcited about anything, because I dropped and I was stuck, you know, very depressed. I thought I had to take some time off work at that stage. And I was, you know, I was really, really sick, really struggling. And you know, it was really difficult, but through there, as I came out the other side, I was like, I've done this public speaking stuff. It's been stripped away from me, so I can't deliver talks. And I thought I could do it online. And what kind of started it all off is I was contacted by Microsoft Ireland, somebody there, and they said, do you want to come and do a talk to some of our guys about your journey? We know we've got a running club here and it'd be great to hear about what you're doing. And that kind of started it. And then I started putting stuff on LinkedIn. Then other people started contacting me, and I've been able to, you know, I've been incredibly fortunate to have been contacted by some, you know, I've never actually gone out of my way to ask anyone if they want me to do a talk, but I've been contacted, you know, I've delivered talks to Burberry, I've delivered talks to the University of New Mexico.
Incredible.
I did one at Direct Line the other day, and it's just unbelievable, like the fact that people want to hear it. And like you say, it is just in this moment of time, it's very kind of apparent, like everyone's struggling.
Do you know what I find one of the most impressive things about you, Ollie, is when you were talking then about your run on the Crescent and stuff like that, it's your motivation behind doing something like that, or your motivation behind running, your motivation behind setting up the website and the blogs, Run For Your Mind, before we move on to the foundation stuff. Your motivation is, you know, your coping mechanism, and you're not going out and looking for business, if that makes sense. You're doing it for you. You're doing it for all the right reasons. And because of that, you're getting the right traction. Like say, you know, you get a video message from Gary Lineker. You know, it's all done really organically, really naturally, because it's your story. It's real. And I think that's the beauty of it that drives it home for me, is that your motivation is so genuine behind the message that people just latch onto it and think, actually, that's at its core is what people need to know. And it's brutally honest and brutally personal.
Yeah, I think that,
you know, that is so, so impressive from where I sit.
Yeah, I mean, it's never, I know we spoke about this before, it's never been about the money, and it's never been about, you know, I didn't even think I could even earn a penny from it. I just wanted to really help other people. But, you know, I'm starting to get myself in a position now that maybe I don't need to work a full-time job. I can focus on, you know, helping people, but also provide my family with a better life. And I think that, you know, ultimately that's what it comes down to now. And, you know, it's been, you know, I've got massive plans with Run For Your Mind, and the foundation that, yeah, you mentioned is just going to be incredible, I believe. And I strongly feel like it's going to be something really special. And that came about because my brother's pretty much my absolute rock. He's, you know, he supports me with everything. Makes me quite emotional actually talking about it.
He's a top bloke.
Yeah, he's incredible. Bloke. And I was in a very bad way about a year ago, and he came up to me and he said, now's the time. And I just turned around to him and went, Sam, now's the time for nothing, mate. Leave me alone. And he went, no, now's the time. I said, what's time for what? He said, you've spoke for 2 or 3 years about turning Run For Your Mind into a charity, and I think now's the time to do it. There's no better time for you to kind of get out of this kind of bad patch you're in, and like kind of switch the focus onto something positive again. And, you know, don't get me wrong, when I'm struggling, I'll still use the running, and it pretty much keeps me afloat. It's like I'm a boy on the sea, really. You know, before I'd really plummet, whereas now I'm bobbing above water all the time. But, you know, he just said to me, look, this is what we need to do. And I was like, you know something, you're probably right. Maybe now is the time. to do something. And we explored the option of setting Run For Your Mind up as a charity, and there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through, and maybe it doesn't need to be a charity as yet. We set it up as a CIC, which is a community interest company, which was came on the back of some solid advice from quite a few people, really, because you can operate in a way that you are a charity in certain respects. You can accept charitable donations and and kind of run it as if it is, but there's less hoops to jump through. And obviously, you kind of...
Which is perfect as you start.
Perfect for starting out. You know, it might turn into something. And you know, what I wanted to do really is I wanted to offer an outlet for people who are struggling. Initially, the idea was to try and help people through the NHS, through social prescribing. I'm not sure everyone will be aware of this kind of initiative they've got in place through the NHS. Whereas, for example... you might, if you said, look, I used to be really fit and healthy and now I can't even leave my house, then and they'd say to you, rather than here's copious amounts of medication, they'll say, here's a person. So they'll prescribe you to somebody else and say, look, this person can help you. Spend a bit of time with them. If it doesn't work, come back to us and then we'll take you through the next steps. Because the wait list now through the NHS can be up to 2 years just to see someone, and that's not acceptable, crazy. It's not acceptable, but how can they keep up with the demand? You know, you know, there's only it's difficult. And you know, and for me, what I want to offer is I want to offer something that's a quick, you know, I want to say it's here for you, you're ready, it's ready. And what I'll offer through the foundation is for anybody who's referred to me, I'll take them to Runner's Need and we'll get them gait analysis and a pair of trainers through the foundation. We offer them a 3-month running plan, which is a tailored plan through a company that I've partnered with called Cooper, who do some incredible things. And what that'll do is kind of give them a plan based on kind of the level of fitness and how they are and so on. And then they'll get a full Run For Your Mind kit. They'll get a box with everything in that's, you know, Run For Your Mind merchandise. And then they'll get one-to-one support through the foundation throughout the 3 months, throughout the whole journey. And I believe that, you know, within 3 months, you will be in a better mental state and through the power of running, really. And this is kind of the package we've created. And we've also got a gym in on board, you know, to offer that as an option. So it could be anything.
That's brilliant.
The difficulty is with the NHS is getting onto this, and everyone wants a piece of it, and it's a bit of a minefield, really. But so I've kind of switched the focus now to sell it more as a corporate package. And it makes more sense, because if I can get into corporate companies and say, look, this is available, you know, and Skybet have said themselves, it's something of interest, because it's very Skybet, it's very quirky, it's different, no one's doing it. It's, you know, something that people can access straight away. And it's, you know, and the idea behind it would be, you know, to try and help people just like me who have been signed off sick and want to find a better way back into work, rather than saying, you know, you might take 3 months off sick, and then you might not see a therapist for another, you know, 12 months or 15 months.
And it's interesting to say that, because you do sort of think that actually speed is one of the biggest factors in helping somebody, you know, whose mental state might be a bit fragile, just from the perspective of they might not know they're in that situation, and then it's, you know, and then it dives, and then they, you know, how quickly you can get to support them is critical.
I think it's massive. I mean, and I'm a living example. I'm stuck with probably OCD now, because I didn't address it when I was 23 years old, or 21, 22 years old when I first started struggling. You know, if I was as well equipped as I am now back then, there's no doubt I'd be in a much better place. But you've got to bear in mind, for me, I've spent nearly 14 years with my mind programmed to think in a different way. It's constantly, you know, I'm talking to you now and I've got a million thoughts going through my head of different things.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly trying to fend these thoughts off and think positive.
I think you've got to look back as well and think, actually, because of my OCD journey and because of, you know, my anxiety and depression, you've obviously suffered through that time, but actually the amount of people you've helped because of that moving forwards is something that they may never have got that help that, you know, that could have actually been really supportive for them.
I mean, the numbers are crazy, honestly. The people I've been able to speak to and support and help through Run For Your Mind, with no real kind of, you know, it's just from my own, just for myself, really. I just wanted to do it, you know, to kind of, you know, do something different and make a difference to people's lives. And you know, I'll never be the same person I was back then, but I'd much prefer to be the person I am today. I'm a million times stronger now. I feel like the way I go about things, I'm a much better person. And, you know, I'm grateful for every battle I've ever faced, because, you know, it's kind of shaped the person I am today. And it's, you know, it's given me, you know, strength that I would never have had in a million years before.
Absolutely. So just to finally wrap things up, if somebody's maybe listening to this or, you know, is struggling, what sort of first bit of advice would you say to somebody who's, you know, might be feeling a bit of, even if they don't know what it is, you know, maybe feel a bit down or anxious about something, what would be your, you know, your first
piece of
advice?
I think the most important thing is really to start to talk, because we're in a very fortunate position. Like when I started on this journey with my mental health many years ago, it wasn't spoke of. It genuinely wasn't. Like it isn't like it is today. And a lot of people now are fighting similar battles. And, you know, and like you've mentioned earlier, like you probably wouldn't just approach me and ask me about my struggles. But actually now, 9 times out of 10, when I meet somebody new, I'll tell them within 15 minutes, because you wouldn't believe how many kind of conversations and how much, you know,
breaks the barrier.
It does. And do you know what? And I tell you something, 50% of people will say, I've had the same issues myself. I've struggled, or my partner's struggling. You know, I did a talk the other day to a small group at Direct Line. I went in and delivered my mental resilience talk there. And one of the managers turned around to me and one of the managers there, and he said, look, you know, my wife struggles with OCD. And he really seemed to be appreciative to have a better understanding about it, because he said he'd always struggled to understand the way she was going about things. Mm. And I think that, you know, it's incredible, you know, opening these conversations. Definitely try and seek professional help, because that's important. You know, there's, you know, I can help you, I can talk to you, but I'm not a professional. I can't give any advice on anything. But, you know, if you feel that you're listening to this and thinking maybe running might help for me, and it might, you know, definitely give me a shout. Get in contact through my Instagram, Run for Your Mind, or through LinkedIn, or Run for Your Mind on my website, and I'll help you out, because that's what it's all about really now. It's kind of, you know, getting as many people involved in this and doing things to better themselves. And, you know,
Ollie, you're amazing, mate. You're amazing, and I can't thank you enough for such a personal, open, honest account of your life and how you've coped with you know, different hurdles, different barriers, and how obviously you're on the running road to, you know, not to recovery, but to just, you know, coping.
I don't think I'll ever recover as such, but it's I can cope, and I appreciate that, Matt. And thanks for the opportunity. It means a lot.
I've really enjoyed my time with you, mate, and I honestly look forward to seeing how the foundation develops and all your running challenges that you do, and you know, and even I might join the Strava club, so I might don the running shoes again. We'll see.
The return.
Oh dear. No, thank you so much, mate.
Yeah, really thanks enjoyed a lot.
It. Cheers. Thanks for listening to the Secret Life of a Business Owner podcast. And for anybody listening who's struggling with their mental health, there are lots of options of support out there, although you may find that some are more suitable for you or more easily available. There's no wrong order to try things in. Different things work for different people at different times. But the key thing is to try and talk, reach out to somebody who can help. And so we've provided lots of links to different organisations in the description of this podcast.